Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 122, recorded Thursday, December 1st, 2011. The buzz about bees. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring available sync with My Ford Touch. Sync with My Ford Touch gets you to your destination with integrated turn-by-turn directions and directional arrows displayed on screen. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki, and once again, you are here for the 1 hour of conversation with one expert in one area of the sciences. And today, I hope you're ready to dig in and get dirty and maybe a little sticky, because we're going to be talking about the science of bees and beekeeping with Erik Stromgren. He's a beekeeper, and I'll be telling you a little bit more about him right before we start our conversation. But first, you know, I like to start the show with a few science headlines to give you an idea of what's going on during the week. So this week, Dartmouth researchers have created a metric for analyzing just how photoshopped images actually are. The tool perceives geometric and photometric changes to images. A study reported in the journal Advanced Materials demonstrates the first ever biocompatible graphene-based transistor array. So far, just a proof of concept, the device may someday be an important part of biomedical interfaces between living tissue and microelectronics. On November 26th, NASA successfully launched the Mars Curiosity rover along with the Mars Science Laboratory aboard an Atlas V rocket. It will touch down on Mars inside Gale Crater on August 6th, 2012, and search for evidence of microbial life on Mars. Canadian researchers report promising results from a small trial of deep brain stimulation on Alzheimer's patients. The technique was used to stimulate the fornix, which is a part of the brain that sends information into the memory-forming hippocampus. Two of six patients had growth rather than shrinkage of the hippocampal regions during the study period. The researchers plan to increase the number of patients in their next study. Modeled on the green chlorosome, an assembly of pigment molecules in green bacteria, scientists at Washington University have built a synthetic light harvesting antenna. Such antennae are important because they allow the bacteria to collect photons of light for photosynthesis and are extremely sensitive to light. The eventual goal is to make highly efficient solar cells based on nature's design. And finally, deictic gestures, those used to draw another individual's attention to an object, like pointing, were recently thought to be a trait only found in primates. However, new research suggests that ravens use their beaks as primates use their hands to make deictic gestures, important in mating behaviors, pointing out things like moss and sticks and twigs and, you know, get the other bird to say, "You like this stick? Let's play with this stick." You know, what else would you do? You point with your beak if you don't have any hands. I think it's very exciting. And that's it for the science headlines this week. I'd like to take this moment to thank our sponsor for the show. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring Sync with My Ford Touch. Sync is the in-car communications, entertainment, and connectivity system that's voice-activated to help you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. One of the great features of Sync is Sync services. Sync Services gives you audible turn-by-turn directions to where you want to go and always displays directional arrows on the screen, all without having to purchase an aftermarket or integrated navigation system. Sync Services also includes business search of over 40 million businesses. That's a lot of businesses. It includes telephone numbers, business information, and directions on how to get there. So you don't have to worry about holding a phone in your hand, searching through a maps app or actual map. That folding paper was quite ungainly. A Send to Sync feature, which enables you to use Google Maps or MapQuest from your home or office computer to plan a trip. Save it online to your Sync traffic directions and information systems account. Then use voice-activated commands in your vehicle to get turn-by-turn directions. A free Sync Destinations app is available in the app stores, and this allows you mobile access to manage your Sync traffic directions and information systems account. On the go, the ability to pre-save destinations to your account, such as home or office, to make it easy to get there. Plus, you can get traffic updates sent to your mobile phone via text message. It's all designed to help you keep your hands on the wheel and eyes on the road. Ford Sync with My Ford Touch is available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about this and other Ford technologies in its vehicles at ford.com/technology. Now back to the show. Our guest today is Eric Stromgren. He's a grad student beekeeper and project manager and instructor for a new commercial beekeeping certificate program that's being offered at Grand Prairie Regional College in Alberta, Canada. Without any further ado, Eric, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Kiki. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I've been following a lot of the bee stories. Colony collapse disorder has been a hot item in the media for several years now, and I think it's time to sit down and have a conversation about bees and find out how much of what we hear about CCD, colony collapse disorder, is hype and how much is fact, how much we know, what do we don't know. So I don't know. Are you ready? I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions.
It's been all over the place. As bad as it was for beekeepers losing hives, it's still, at least people know what we do now, and they're getting curious. So,
right, and I've seen maybe not so much the commercial beekeeping programs. I haven't really seen huge beekeeping at a large scale, but I know here in San Francisco there are people who have small apiaries, small beekeeping setups in their backyard. So
yeah, that's becoming more and more common. There's more and more people as we start to get interested in taking a little bit of control over our own food system. More and more people are keeping two hives in their backyard or in a community garden plot or something like that, and that's really, to me, a good thing.
So what got you interested in beekeeping? How did you, is this something that you've done forever?
Yeah, I didn't have much of a choice in the matter. I came into this like most beekeepers. I had a relative who was a beekeeper. My uncle, from the time I was very young, kept a couple of hives just more or less as a hobby, and he'd take me and other cousins out to look at the hives when we were fairly young. And so anybody with a mind for science or nature would be stuck with the beekeeping addiction pretty early on.
What do you find really just addictive about beekeeping? What is it to you that just really gets you entranced by the bees?
To me, it's just that there's always something new with them. You never know everything about them, and the more you learn, the more questions you have. And so I like learning new things, and I especially like teaching other people interesting things, and there's no end of it with bees.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they hear about bees or even beekeeping, there's this instant fear because bees sting. Should we really, And people die from bee stings. Anaphylactic shock is very deadly. You know, how afraid should people really be?
It kind of depends on where you are. In Canada and most of the U.S., not afraid at all. There's some parts of U.S. and Central and South America where there are Africanized bees, or some people call them killer bees. And there, it's a little bit more of a concern if you're if you're deathly allergic to them. But in general, the bees, they're not out to sting you. They don't want to. A honeybee dies when she stings, and so she has to have a pretty good reason.
Right. So they're not like wasps or yellow jackets where they can either sting multiple times or they bite you. It's they're much more delicate creatures, right?
Yeah, they have a honeybee has a barbed stinger, and so she when she stings, the stinger will stay in you wherever she's stung, and there's a little venom gland and a muscle attached to that stinger that rips out the end of her abdomen, and it will keep pumping venom into you, and it'll keep trying to pump for 5 minutes, I've heard.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of it's a different approach to delivering the most venom they can. A wasp colony is at the biggest 2,000 to 3,000 insects. Mm-hmm. And so they can't afford to lose many to colony defense. But a honeybee colony with 60,000 bees, if a few of them die delivering a sting, then so be it.
So let's talk a little. I think that's really, really interesting and a really good place to start talking about the honeybee colony, this ecosystem that they live in. You know, what's their basic biology that we should be aware of? It's such a difference having this huge amount of individuals that they live with. How does that affect their basic biology?
The biggest difference between the honeybees and their closest relatives, which are wasps and other bees and ants, is that they have to live in a social environment. They have to be part of a colony. And so we can lose colonies just because enough bees have died out of that colony that it can't support itself any longer. With an ant or a wasp or a bumblebee, they start out their colony with just one insect, and she does all the work. But with honeybees, that could never happen. So we have to always make sure we have a whole healthy colony rather than worry about individual insects.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about I understand that there's a queen individual, and then there are maids that help the queen, and there are drones, and then we also have the little larva and the nurses that raise the larva. What is the proportion of individuals and types of individuals that you find in a colony, and what do they do?
In a colony, we'll talk about the adults first. In a colony, there are three, we call them castes. There's a queen, which is the fertile mother. She's the only egg layer in the colony, and there's only one, usually in a colony, only one queen. Almost all the other bees in the colony are sterile females, and we call them workers. And the worker bees do all of the jobs. The job they're best at depends on how old they are. The youngest ones are better at taking care of the hive, better at taking care of the young bees and feeding the queen. And the older ones are better at defending the hive and foraging for food. And then the third caste is the drones. And they're only around in the summer. A drone is the boy bee. He's haploid. So he doesn't have a father. He's just he's just born from the queen. And his only job is to mate with the queen from another colony. And so the bees keep him around, the few drones in the colony, 300 to 500 at the peak in the summer. And they're around only when there are new queens being produced for mating. And at the end of the year, at the end of the summer, in British Columbia, it happens in about the last week of August, the workers kick all the drones out of the colony and kill them.
Wow. We've had enough of you. Get out.
You're not sitting. Out you go.
Yeah. You're not doing your job anymore. It's not the right season. Go away.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have the, and I think it's interesting you mentioned that they're haploid. So for the definition of that, they only have half of a complement of chromosomes. So they're only getting the queen's set?
Yes.
But this is also interesting, though, because bees have different genetics from humans. Because where we have an X and a Y or an XX, we have basically double chromosomes. Don't bees have something that's slightly different?
The female bees are all diploid, and the way sex determination works in bees and I believe the most of the rest of the hymenoptera is there are alleles of a certain gene that determine sex.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is if you're diploid and you have two different copies of the allele, there are multiple variants of the allele.
Mm-hmm.
If you have two different copies, you come up female. But if you have only one copy, which is the case if you're haploid, you come up male. But what we can get are if a queen mates with a close relative, that drone that's a close relative will have a copy that may be similar to one of the copies the queen has. And so if she tries to lay eggs fertilized by that father, they'll be diploid, but it will start to grow as a male. And that's not allowed to happen. So the workers just eat them.
So they
eat them while they're still young.
So that those larvae, those eggs that are developing into larvae, those just get eaten.
Yeah, the ones that would be a diploid male aren't viable. And this is a big problem for bee breeders. If we only have a couple of colonies to start with, the variance in the number of sex alleles that are in our breeding population can be too small. And the queens that are produced from that won't be viable. There's a very strong inbreeding effect when your sex determination is genetic like this.
Yeah, that wouldn't end up helping a colony at all. And if you have a lot of inbreeding, that can also lead to weaker immune systems, which is very important for stuff like the mites, funguses that infect the colonies.
Yeah, you end up losing a lot of the variation that's available. And so when you have a new pest or something that the bees haven't encountered for a while, they may have lost the variant they need to be able to deal with that problem. Or in the case of a lot of the pests we're seeing, they're introduced to the honeybees. And so there would only be a very few to begin with that might be resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And too much inbreeding, that's all of a sudden we don't have anything to deal with the new pests.
In the wild, let's talk about normal colony growth, and you have when you have multiple queens, eventually doesn't a colony split when it has two queens, where one queen will take a lot of members and form a new hive?
We call that process swarming.
Okay.
And that's because the bees are social, because they can't start from one insect. If you think about an ant colony or a bumblebee colony, they produce a whole bunch of mated queens, and the queen goes out to start her own colony. But in honeybees, that doesn't work, so they have to start with the whole colony. So when the colony gets big and there's a lot of food available, and this usually happens in the spring, the workers will start to raise a new queen. And because queens and workers are both born from fertilized eggs,
mm-hmm.
There's no difference for the first between the eggs or for the first 2 days of the larva's life. The difference comes with what the bee eats as it's growing. And so they can take any of the worker eggs and they feed them something called royal jelly, which is
superfood for bees.
The superfood for bees.
Yeah.
It's enzymes that the bees produce in two glands behind their face. If the bee eats that the whole time she's developing, she becomes a queen. And so when the colony is very strong, the workers will select a whole bunch of larvae, they'll feed them royal jelly, and they'll all start to develop as queens. Mm-hmm. And just before they emerge as adults, the workers in the colony will kick the old queen out, and a little over half of them will go with her. And they'll find a new place to start a colony. And then when the first new queen hatches, when she's born when she finishes pupation and emerges as an adult in the colony, she runs around and kills all the rest. And then she goes on a mating flight and mates with a whole bunch of drones. It's a very good week for her. And then she's stuck inside running the rest of the colony for the rest of her life.
And what's the average lifetime of a queen?
We say in a commercial beekeeping colony, it can be very short. But in the wild, we say on average 3 years. And there's reports of them living 5 to 7 years.
Wow, that's actually quite long lived. I had no idea a bee could live that long.
Yeah, it's a really long time. And the two differences between the queen and her sisters who are born in the hive at the same time are the food she eats. Mm-hmm. She eats royal jelly, and her sisters eat a less rich form of jelly called worker jelly and some honey and pollen. And then the queen doesn't have to do a heck of a lot. She has to stay in the hive, and she has to lay a lot of eggs, which is demanding.
Right.
But she doesn't have to do all the rest of the work, and she doesn't have to fly and forage. So she doesn't wear out as quickly as the workers do. And her workers, in the summer, they might only live 6 weeks, 45 days.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a difference.
Yeah. It's a big difference.
It's a hard life.
A worker bee that is raised to live a long time and not do a lot of work, one that's going to carry the colony through winter when they're just sitting still, they might live 6 months. But it's still nowhere close to a queen bee's 3, 5, 7 years.
Yeah, not at all. In the wild, when you have this swarming event, you're talking about this is a normal event for a healthy, strong colony that has the energy to spare and the individuals to spare to have new queens and a new colonization event. But in the in your beekeeping situation, do you try and keep the number of queens down? Do you go through and get rid of queens to be proto queens?
It's a bad thing. We don't let the bees. We try not to let them get so strong that they swarm.
Okay.
We want to have the hive reach that point just before the point that they're going to swarm, because that's when they're the strongest and they're going to do the most work for us. Whether we're pollinating crops or producing honey, we want as many bees in the hive as we can. But once they swarm, then they have to concentrate on rebuilding the hive, and they're not doing much for us. And really, swarms are fascinating, and they're really gentle. If anybody sees them hanging on a tree branch, they're the gentlest state in the bee's life. But I've met very few people who like to have a swarm hanging in their backyard. So it's really bad PR for beekeepers if we let our hive swarm all over the place.
Yeah, I remember when growing up, at one point we had a bee colony in an old hollow tree stump on our property, and at one point it swarmed, and we had to call in a beekeeper to come and take the swarm away. go take the swarm away.
And the beekeepers love doing that, because swarms are at a time of year when everything's right for making more bees, so it's freebies for us.
You're like, yes, more colony. Excellent. For what you're doing, there's a question in the chat room, so talking about the strength of the colonies and what you're dealing with, the genetic stock that you're already dealing with in the beekeeping situation. In the wild, you've probably got a lot of genetic diversity, a lot of mixing of individuals. For beekeeping, is it the same, or do you, as the quote from the chat room, Jacksonfly, are honey bees inbred like hybrid poodles to begin with? Are they all imported to begin with? And so do they have very little natural resistance, or are they pretty diverse?
Well, honeybees are introduced to North America. The bees that we farm, the western honeybee, the species Apis mellifera, comes from Europe and Africa and Asia, and there's about 25 subspecies. We farm mainly two of them in North America, and we've had basically no new stock introduced to North America since 1922. So we have a very limited gene pool available, and very few people breeding queens. So even the gene pool we do have available, we don't use all of it in the commercial queen breeding industry. In their native range, I would imagine there's still a fair bit of genetic diversity, and there are one or two people around who are trying to work on bringing in, we can't bring in the bees, but we can bring in semen from drones. So they'll go over to areas in Europe where there are wild colonies or even managed colonies that still have a lot of genetic diversity, and collect semen from drones, freeze it, and bring it back for use in breeding programs in North America. But this is still very recent for us, within the last few years that these programs have
is that part
been
of
trying
the,
to go.
Yeah, is that part of the response to colony collapse disorder?
It's a little bit before that. They started working on this. There's a researcher in Washington State that's been doing a fair bit of this. It's kind of in response to some work he did in, I believe, in the 90s, where he looked at how few colonies are acting as the source of almost all the queens we produce, and then trying to bring in some more diversity. But it's very difficult. The laws on importing bees are fairly clear cut. They were written at a time when simple language would suffice, and that's hard to get around.
Yeah. Don't bring in bees from other places.
it's almost a commandment.
Yeah. Do you have the Ten Commandments of beekeeping? Exactly. These are the rules you follow. Another question from the chat room from T. Beauchamp. Has colony collapse disorder affected wild colonies to the same degree as domestic colonies? Or is there a way to assess that?
It's really hard to assess that. Colony collapse disorder isn't a disease or something we can test for. It's only something we describe based on the symptoms we see. And so we see it in managed colonies. And in particular, we see it in managed colonies in California and the southern half of the U.S. Because the time of year the bees die at, in northern areas, we're not even looking in the hives at that time. So for beekeepers in Canada, even if we had it, there's a small chance we'd actually see it. We don't think we do have it, but it would be hard for us to tell even if we did.
What do you think it is about? So Canada hasn't been hit by CCD. What is it about Canadian beekeeping that's keeping things safer?
It's, as near as I can tell, it's partly the way our beekeeping season works. We can't move our bees south, so they're not active all winter long. And we can't check them in the winter, so we wouldn't notice even if we had colony collapse disorder. But for most of Canada, our management strategies are a little bit less intense than some of the migratory operations in the U.S. I worked for years in the Lower Mainland in British Columbia, around Vancouver. And for us, migratory beekeeping is a 45-minute drive. It's not Florida to California.
What do you mean by migratory beekeeping?
Migratory beekeeping is the practice of moving hives. Mm-hmm. And for mostly it's for crop pollination. So we'll move hives in the spring, I'll move hives into blueberries, and then into raspberries and cranberries, and then into pumpkins and zucchini and squash.
I want to buy your honey. That sounds lovely. Blueberry honey, I'll take it.
Yeah. And that's the same process happens in the U.S., only the way agriculture is, there are big regions with crops. So California for almonds, Washington or Maine for blueberries, and the Dakota for honey production later in the summer. Big moves, long, a lot of time spent on the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so common in Canada. There's lots of little things that we do differently, and because we don't actually know what CCD is, it's really hard for us to say what is it that's different that makes us not have it.
Right.
We've still been losing lots of colonies.
Right. Yeah, I've heard a lot. So in terms of what CCD is, all we know so far is that we have die-offs of whole colonies. But is it that individuals are just flying off, dying someplace else, not coming back? Do you come back to the hive and there are a bunch of dead individuals? And often associated with it, there's varroa mite. There's also some kind of fungus that's been associated, and then a whole bunch of immune system signatures that basically suggest that the bees are trying to fight stuff off.
Yeah, it's the strange thing about colony collapse disorder is it's a disease where you have an absence of bees. You have a colony that looks like it should be healthy, but there's no bees in it. The adult bees have disappeared, which that's one of the biggest problems with trying to understand what's going on with colony collapse disorders. We have nothing. It's difficult for us to get anything to look at to identify what the disease could be.
So you don't have individuals to look at. You can't identify what's potentially wrong. With the migratory beekeeping that you're talking about, I'm just wondering, do the bees get tired of being moved? Do they know that their hive has been moved? In terms of bee memory, their little mushroom bodies, how much information can the little mushroom body bee brain actually take in terms of environmental navigation, finding that flower, getting back to the hive before the bee just finally goes, I'm fed up. I'm not going to go back.
They've been moved. They orient. They know where they live, anywhere within about 3 kilometers from their hive. So where the beekeepers move them outside that range. Oh, my son's coming to see what we're doing. Can you run upstairs?
Okay. Hello, child.
Just talking for a minute. Can you run upstairs?
Grandma needs you.
Tell her I'm on the phone.
That was sweet. Mama needs you.
So what was I saying? Yeah, they know they've been moved. They can remember basically anywhere within 3 kilometers of the hive. They know how to find their way back. Once we move them outside of that, they're completely lost, and the first thing they do is figure out where the hive is in the new landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not too big of an issue, but it is a little bit stressful for them. You can imagine it would be having to do something brand new and find new food and do that extra work to explore the neighborhoods. And so for an animal that dies when it exhausts itself, that might cost them a day on their life. And if you end up with, one of the things we're thinking is if you end up with workers dying off a day or two early even, that means the younger bees that are taking care of the brood, the babies, eggs, larvae, and pupa in the hive, have to recruit to the field force a little bit earlier. And so what's going on in the hive doesn't get as much attention as maybe it should. And then this is when the diseases can and manifest themselves. The bees are usually pretty good at taking care of diseases, at least the ones they've evolved with. The new ones, it's harder, but...
Is there any evidence that suggests that might be true? Have people looked at their bee colonies and actually aged the bees and said, okay, this one's a few days, these bees are younger, these bees are heading out earlier, these bees that are younger have more active immune systems or more swamped immune systems?
Well, you get this idea from a couple of lines of evidence. One of the things we can do is we can mark cohorts of bees on the day they're born. We can, mm-hmm. we can take the frames of the comb that the bees are on, and we can incubate them and mark everybody that's born on a certain day. And then we can look at how long those live, how long they're foraging for. And we can see if they are younger, and we can get an idea if they're a day or two younger. But other evidence comes in when we look at the behavior of the bees when they catch a disease. And one of the things we see is in colonies with a disease, the young bees start foraging earlier. They get out of the hive. And probably it's a response not to spread the disease within the hive. But then that's decreasing the number of workers looking after the babies. And then from computer models, we see that even just a few days, just losing a few extra bees to early recruitment to the field force can start the hive going backwards.
I need to take a quick break to thank our sponsor. I'd like to say that this episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, saving you time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac, PC, iPad, iPhone, even Android phones, if that's what you have. You can also use gaming consoles like an Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii and watch Netflix right on your TV. If you're not a gamer, you can also use Roku Box or an Apple TV, inexpensive and very easy to use with Netflix. You can begin watching instantly on any of these devices, and then when you're done watching, and say it's the middle of the show and you need to take a break, you can stop watching and then start watching where you left off on any other device. So say you have to leave your house and go mobile, you can watch on the bus when you were watching on your computer at home. Very convenient service. Whichever way you decide to choose, you decide to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies or TV shows as you want, any time you want, and you can cancel at any time for completely no charge. Try Netflix today. 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's right. Go to this website, netflix.com/twit. Get your free 30-day trial of Netflix. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix for their support of Twit. We hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. So back to the beekeeping. We are talking with Eric Stromgren about bees and beekeeping, talking a lot about colony collapse disorder and a lot of the genetic influences, environmental influences, and along environmental lines, the beekeeping influences to colony collapse disorder, what we know about it, the health of the bees. Eric, we're talking about how, you know, the colony collapse disorder is happening around the world, but more in some places than others, and it might have to do with the migratory beekeeping practices. It might have to do with other things altogether. We don't know a lot about it, even though people have been working on this for years now. It seems like that, like, we've been talking about it and working on it for a long time. So, is colony collapse disorder the the scary thing that we've been led to believe it is? Do we have to worry about losing all of our bees?
It is a big problem. Beekeepers, we're doing a lot of work every year to try to maintain the level of colonies that we have. But in the U.S., and the figures are similar for Canada, since 1950, we've lost half our colonies. And what the industry needs, what agriculture needs, and what the beekeepers need are more beekeepers and more colonies, not to be struggling along just to maintain the status quo. And we've done it by splitting our hives more than we would like to, and we've done it by importing bees from other countries, which has its good side and its bad side. We'd be more than happy if we were growing rather than holding steady or losing bees.
Yeah, is it a problem of keeping bees alive to maintain the colony numbers, or is it the fact that the beekeeping profession is dwindling also?
It's a little bit of both. There aren't nearly as many people with 10 or 50 or 100 colonies as there used to be. There's still the same number of people with 1,000, 2,000, or maybe there's a little bit less, but there's still people with thousands of colonies, and there's beekeepers with 80,000 colonies. And there's increasing interest in the beekeepers having one or two in their backyard. But for doing what beekeepers do, moving hives a little bit and taking care of pollination locally and producing local honeys, we're losing a lot of people in that intermediate stage. And that's really, I think the people in the intermediate stage they're the safety net for the industry.
So the people who aren't beekeeping on a massive scale, and also who aren't just having a couple of boxes in their backyard, but you know, are maybe have a couple hundred or so, maybe a couple of thousand, but are, you know, related to maybe an organic farm or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, for a commercial beekeeper, a guy with thousands of colonies, it doesn't make sense for us to pollinate small fields, a crop that only needs 10 hives or 20 hives. We have to put it in a huge monoculture field that needs lots of bees in order for us to be able to make money. But somebody with 100 colonies, they could pollinate however many fields that need two colonies that they want. And that's how, in my opinion, we're going to get a little bit of control over local food systems, being able to have small farms be viable. We need the beekeepers to do the pollination, and we have very few people right now that can do that.
In terms of the pollination, you talk about needing beekeepers to do the pollination. Do we need beekeepers really to do it, or is it not happening enough in the wild on its own?
It's a bit of a complicated question. For crop pollination, honeybees are often not the best insect for the job. There are other insects that will do a better job. Bumblebees will work longer and in worse weather. And there's solitary bees that they'll work at just the right time of year. What we can do with honeybees is put a lot of them into fields. And so we could pollinate most crops just by brute force.
Right.
We might not have the best insect, but we can put millions in the fields. And so the question is, you know, if we need honeybees for pollination, the way agriculture is set up right now, yes, we do. We don't have the habitat or the resources on the landscape to support enough native bees. And that's not an ideal situation.
Yeah.
But it's the one we're faced with. And so if this is the situation we're in, we need the beekeepers. I'd love to see more diverse landscapes where we could have more pollination by native species of bees. But that's still a while off if it ever comes.
Yeah, and this gets into a whole bigger question about agriculture in general and how the big agribusiness works. And as you're saying, monocultures, not necessarily the best thing. And the way that we do agribusiness, it's damaging to the soil. There are a lot of things, but gets a lot of food out to a lot of people, and that's kind of what we need. So, you know, how are we going to be able to balance all of these different factors, the health of the bees, pollinating the crops that we have? Is agribusiness really the way that we're going to be able to continue forward? Is it the only way that we can continue to be able to feed everybody? You know, all very big questions.
They're big questions, and questions we've spent, one of my degrees is from the old faculty of agriculture at University of British Columbia. And we spent, I don't know how many hours talking about this and whether we can transition out of agribusiness the way it's set up right now, or whether we should, or how that works. But in the end, it came to, this is the situation that we're in. And really, we have to find a decent way of working with this system before we try to change everything overnight.
Right, right. Try and work within the system, make it work as well as possible, and then maybe see if you can adjust it to something that might be better overall for the planet. For what you're working on, we're getting towards the end of the hour here. So the beekeeping program that you've got going, what are your hopes for the program? Hopes for beekeeping in general as you're moving forward?
Well, our goal up here is to start training the next generation of beekeepers. It's a familiar thing in a lot of industries, but there's a lot of beekeepers who have a lot of gray hair. And as they start to retire, there's very few people to take their places. Some are able to sell their operation to a new beekeeper, but in a lot of cases, we're seeing a commercial beekeeper that retires split his operation up and sell it to all the other old beekeepers who are in his neighborhood. And so to make some progress on increasing the number of hives and increasing the number of beekeepers, we've got this program at Grand Prairie Regional College. And we had one in the 80s and 90s that trained beekeeper technicians, and then that ended. And now this is I don't know why it's this long after a colony collapse has sort of reared its head, but maybe it's just the speed of bureaucracy to build the momentum to do something.
Right.
But now we've started this, and we're going to try to train beekeepers with the best of current knowledge. Everything's changed in the 10 years that the program hasn't been running. So we're working our best to do that and at least start beekeepers on the right practices. Trying to manage beekeepers is like herding cats, but it's we're going to give it our best.
It's a difficult job, but you know, you can be really proud of yourself when you're done.
Yeah.
It's great product that comes out of it once you've done herding the beekeepers. For people who might be interested, where can they find information about the beekeeping certificate program? And additionally, if they're not in Canada and can't make it to your certificate program, where would you send people to find out about more about bees?
The easiest way to find out about bees is there are local bee clubs all over the place, and the bee club in the neighborhood is usually a great source of information. They're almost always also a great source of misinformation. So everything you hear, you take with a grain of salt. But if beekeepers, we seldom agree on anything. So if you get two or three people telling you the same thing, that's probably something to pay attention to. For about the program that we're working on, this year we're taking Canadian students, and our hope is next year we'll open it up internationally. But for that, I'm the easiest person to get in touch with. I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Gmail. I'm Beekeeper Eric in all of those places.
Okay.
And so it's easy enough to find me.
Fantastic. Eric, this has been just a really interesting hour. I became a huge fan of bees when I read a book called Of Honeybees and Fairy Dust when I was a little girl. And it was this whole story. And I can't remember who wrote it, but the book is long gone. I have no idea where it went, but great book. Some kids run into some fairies who turn them the size of bees, and then they run around beehives and learn about the biology of bees. It was just a great story.
That sounds like a great book.
Yeah, I really wanted to be. I imagined being shrunk down to the size of a bee and getting to crawl around the hive, the honeycomb.
I love that.
I know.
Get a bee's eye perspective on the world.
I know. It would be great. But thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today. This was great.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And everyone out there, that's right, follow Beekeeper Eric on Twitter, Facebook, Gmail. If you have any questions about bees, like he said, that's where you can find him. And this about does it for this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. We're done for the day. Next week, we will be finding out information about the Earth, the annual American Geophysical Union is having their conference in San Francisco, so I'm looking to get an insider's perspective. And so that's what we're going to be doing next week. If you want to find out what is the newest, hottest research on Earth, got to tune in next Thursday to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Until then, you can find my sciencey pursuits on all the social media places. I'm Dr. Kiki, and you can email me drkiki@drkiki.tv if you have any questions or suggestions for the show. I'm always open to cool videos for the science meditation of the week, suggestions for guests, questions. You know, can I connect you with anybody that I've had an interview with in the past, or, you know, whatever. Try and do that. You know, you can always connect with me on social media as well. My website is drkiki.tv. And what else do I need to tell you? If you need more sciencey goodness, you can download past episodes of this program at twit.tv/kiki. Also, you can tune in to the Twit Network or look for This Week in Science, which airs weekly on Thursdays on the Twit Network as well, twist.org. I'll see you next week. Thank you for tuning into my Science Hour. Remember, all I ask is 1 hour a week. Maybe a few more, but really, just one. That's all I ask for sure. And I do hope that that hour makes your week a whole lot more interesting. Now, for your science meditation of the week.
Leaves behind brine that is so extremely salty, it sinks rapidly. As it descends, the seawater around it freezes instantly and forms a sheath of ice, a brinicle, that grows downwards towards the seafloor. Winter is reaching down from the cold world above. As it touches the seafloor, it kills whatever living thing it contacts by encasing it in a tomb of ice. Even in the relative warmth of the water, the lethal cold of winter threatens life on the seafloor.
Ah, it's incredible the stuff that happens under the sea. Under the sea. Take it from me. Down where it's wetter. That's right. I will now sing the entire repertoire of The Little Mermaid. Not. Interesting thing about that that video from the BBC is that it was filmed over 5 or 6 hours, so it appears to move very quickly. The starfish are like scurrying along the bottom of the ocean. They don't move that fast in reality, so it's been time shifted so that it occurs under the couple of minutes that they used for that segment. Echinoderm popsicle. Nice web 8965. What did somebody ask? It's called a brinicle. Brine icicle. You can imagine that a super condensed salt water, so it's highly salty, briny, has a lower freezing temperature. So it's not going, so the temperature of the water is not necessarily going to freeze it immediately. And so the brine moves down, cooling the water around it. And as it cools, it freezes the water. The brine, the salt goes, gets concentrated more. Going in, the water freezes. The salt gets concentrated more. And it extends this brinicle to the bottom of the ocean. It's pretty interesting, right? If anybody is in the Bay Area and interested, I'm going to be giving a talk at Cafe Valparaiso in Berkeley on Wednesday, December 14th. I think it's December 14th. I hope that's my calendar right. Wednesday, December 14th, I'm going to be talking about sensationalism and science and the media and, you know, it's small talk, lots of discussion. I can do lots of talk and a little discussion. Topic. Yeah, just a small topic, right?